Hey, Curiosity Builders, I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative entrepreneurs, storytellers, visionaries, and changemakers who are on a mission of chasing big ideas, telling epic stories, and leaving living legacies. Whether you're just starting out or have been at this creative and curious life for some time, I hope you'll learn something new in this podcast and find yourself inspired to break through the barriers that hold you back and keep you stuck from getting your work to work. From search engines, algorithms, design and technology, to what it means to be uniquely human, today's guest weekly inspires me with his email newsletter, Don't Think About the Future, to think deeply about unexpected topics. Chris Butler is a writer, designer, manager, consultant, and creator at Newfangled. I've had the pleasure of talking with him before on Getting Work to Work, and you'll find links to those past conversations in the show notes. In this conversation, he dives into some fascinating topics that he is thinking about after 4 years of political turmoil, technological changes, and the effects of a global pandemic. He also shares insight into 2 recent essays he wrote, the first about why search engines don't work and aren't good, and the second about what it means to dream big. Show notes and links to all the good stuff mentioned in this episode can be found at gwtw.co/505.
Hi, I'm Chris Butler, and I'm endlessly curious about just about everything, which is kind of a great way to get out of answering the question. But, you know, when I thought about that, I thought to myself, well, what am I not curious about? There aren't that many things. I guess I'd be honest and say I'm not exactly curious about sports. That's just something that never really pops up for me. But other than that, if you were to look at my nightstand or my to-read list or the kinds of things I like to talk about, they're kind of all over the map. But for the purposes of this conversation, you know, ultimately, when I think about what I write about, what I talk about most, I'm really curious about the ways that the things we make get in our own way, the ways that the things we make get in the way of being a human being on this planet, which is kind of an endless why are you hitting yourself kind of scenario, but it's definitely one we've all experienced.
Wow. And I mean, 2020 is the year where there was always something in the news about a technology or a disease or some issue at the forefront of holding us back as a species.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of the year of why are you hitting yourself, you know, or maybe the last 4 years have just been like one increasing crescendo in that regard. But right. It is true. I mean, it seems that the faster things go, the more we try to keep up with that pace to our detriment. We make mistakes and we don't think things through and we think something's going to be good and it turns out to not be that great. Right. So yeah, haste makes waste.
Haste makes waste, but also what I'm laughing about too is like what we think is good can sometimes be bad, and the things that we think are bad can sometimes have such a impactful positive effect on us in the long run that we can't see in the moment.
That is true. I think, you know, we're recording this in early 2021, and at this point it's been about a year that we've been under all kinds of new conditions due to a global pandemic. And perhaps we'll listen back onto this some years from now and think about, you know, the net gains that came out of that. We'll think about some of the losses. I mean, it's, I still feel a little bit too close to the situation to really, I guess, weigh that out. Mm-hmm. But there's been a lot of bad and there's been some good too. And that comes with any kind of change, no matter how big or how small it is. And I can see those things for myself right now, for sure. You and I were talking about some of them before we hit record, but it's also true that in talking about those, it can be really too easy to glaze over or to diminish the losses or the suffering or the struggles that other people have had through this situation as well. And so it's probably too early to weigh it out, but it is certainly the case that some years from now, we'll probably see it differently than we do today.
Right. Well, I mean, just the mere fact alone that it's taken me, I think it took me almost 10 months to really emotionally process what I was feeling over the last year.
Yep. Yeah, I'm sure you're not alone in that regard. Not only that, but I mean, I'm, you know, figuring out how you feel about something is a meta process, right? I mean, it's a process of feeling a lot of different things up and down every day. You know, and a lot of that is measured by fear and the unknown. You know, if we think again specifically about the pandemic, we still don't really know everything that we probably need to know or want to know about this particular virus, how it works, you know, why certain people are more vulnerable than others, how it plays out, what's effective in healing people who have it. There's all kinds of things about this that we still don't know enough about. And so if that's true a year into it, I mean, think back to last March when, you know, we all decided to lock things down and stay home and, you know, no one had any idea what it was going to look like or how vulnerable they were or right. How vulnerable certain systems were to that. And so people were stockpiling toilet paper and all kinds of stuff, you know, and all that's fear driven, fear because of the unknown.
Yeah. What's interesting is just this morning I was reading a book and it was talking about people who need that sense of certainty are more susceptible to things like dogma or propaganda or those things that can keep us stuck in our old way of thinking. And the way out of that was through, you know, curiosity and allowing yourself to be flexible in the moment. And I'm like, it's really hard to do that.
It is very hard. It is. And I can relate to that personally. I mean, there were times in my past when I was much more dogmatic out of a need for certainty. You know, and that was very much embedded in my personality and my preferences and all that stuff. But I think I've learned to be more comfortable with not knowing certain things and uncertainty. And that's still coming from someone who, you know, I'm prone to anxiety. And I think people who are prone to anxiety like certainty as well. yes. You know, the more certainty they have, the less factors contribute to their anxiety. But I think they're also tend to be intelligent enough to know how shallow certainty can be. So, you know, you can erode it through your own thinking and it becomes a self-perpetuating cycle. So yeah, I can relate to that fully.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting too, because just in that alone, there's the things that we're certain of because they're in our control. And then there's the things that we want to be certain of that we will never have control of.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. There's a limit to certainty. And I think, yeah, to your earlier point, if you can get comfortable with that, it makes, I guess, day-to-day life a whole lot easier for sure.
Well, one of the things, Chris, that I am really loving right now is all of the writing that you are doing. And man, every time a new essay pops into my inbox, my mind is just blown.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. That means it's working. Thank you.
So what led to the resurgence of writing? Because it's been a while since my inbox lit up with these great essays.
Yeah. You know, prior to 2017, I think I was probably just as active as this, but a lot changed in this country with our last president's term. And I found myself turning a ton of my daily attention toward that. And, you know, what norm has been violated today? Whose rights are being threatened now? And what fresh outrage is being flaunted before us this morning? What new low of corruption is being plumbed? You know, every day brought this new intensity to the vacuum that was the Trump administration's like uncanny ability to suck the air out of every room, of every conversation, you know, to make everything invalid or irrelevant in light of whatever it was doing. So, you know, here I was, where I tended to write about design and technology and things like that. And I'd be like, well, what does this matter, you know, right now? So, you know, during the time, I'm not the kind of person that wants to ignore government entirely. I think, you know, we've learned now, at least I've learned now, that it's critical that we all understand and participate in how our communities work. But I also don't want to think about that every single moment of every day. You know, I have other interests. And so I have to say, you know, the resurgence is because as that has changed, I found myself with this like renewed energy toward those things that I've always been interested in. And I actually feel it in my body, a difference in that I have more energy day to day. I am reading more. I'm not just writing more. I'm reading more. I'm being a little bit more thoughtful about the stuff I do take in. And I'm being a little bit more thoughtful about filtering out some of the stuff that I let kind of control the last 4 years of my headspace. So I think that's the explanation, to be honest.
I love that explanation a lot. And the first thing that popped into my head was the whole idea of why we have a representative democracy is so that the public doesn't have to be involved in every step of the decision making.
It's true. And in general, that sounds fantastic, doesn't it?
Right. It does.
Yeah, it does. Because not all of us really want to live lives that are concerned with government, right? Some people really want to be participating in government. Some people want to write about that. Some people want to watch it and evaluate it, you know, and there's all kinds of things you can do in a society if that's what you want. But societies are complicated and there are people, some people just want to make things, you know, and I think that there needs to be room for people who don't want to focus on government in a society to do so. And that's what representative government is for. Yeah. That's also what farming is for, you know, like, you know, it allows a culture to flourish when not everyone has to do the same things to survive. But at the same time, I think this experience that our country has had is one that reveals how much of government is run on promises and agreements and normalcy, as opposed to, you know, some kind of lockable mechanism that everyone interprets the same way. And I think, you know, as soon as you get someone in office who's willing to take advantage of every loophole or every unspecified rule, then you can end up with disarray quite quickly. And I think that's where we ended up.
Yeah, and it's really interesting to think about the whole notion of an objective definition of normalcy or what a norm is.
Yeah, I mean, no such thing exists, right? Yeah. You know, and that's probably at the root of what makes culture great is that everybody sees the world differently. I think what also makes culture great is that when people who see the world differently can agree on how to live in it, you know, so that it doesn't threaten each other's ability to see it differently. Yeah. You know, I think that, and that's, you know, something that seems like our culture in America, we've lost that, the ability to disagree and cohabitate. But, you know, I think that's restorable if people want it to be.
So I have to ask, like, how do we live in a world where we can disagree yet live with one another? I mean, there's a big question for you that I hope you'll address in a future writing.
Yeah, if I could answer that question, I mean, the power, the immense power. It's on the one hand, it seems like the answer is really straightforward, doesn't it? Just like, you know, be decent to one another. You know, if
like
my
Bill
neighbor,
and Ted.
Right? If my neighbor had totally different opinions to me about most things, I feel like I could still find some way to at least respect them as a human being. I think the threat to that becomes when we take certain actions because of what we think and believe. And that's where I think it really starts to degrade for, at least for me, is that, you know, it's, if I look at somebody who might have a completely different opinion politically to me, in this country, I would be fine with having a discussion with them about that and sorting it all out. But as soon as that person takes actions that they think are appropriate because of their views politically that seem to be self-contradictory to other views that they have, or just basically unacceptable from a human ethics standpoint, or that, then I have a problem engaging. And that's where I've been the most confused, honestly, in the last few years, is that I found myself very surprised by some of the people that I've observed who've ended up being the loudest in opposition to things that I thought we had agreement about. I don't know. I'm trying to be somewhat circumspect in the way that I talk about this, because I don't want to get too drawn into, like, you know, Trump hating conversation, right? Or, you know, Trump follower conversation. But I do think that there is a basic fracturing to how we engage with one another, and if I could solve that, man, so many things could come from that. But I don't think one person can solve it.
Right. Well, and because I think too, it's like most things, a two-way street.
Right.
Which is, I think, where perhaps that's where it's gone off the rails, is that we don't allow that conversation to occur. We're just shouting at each other.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's true.
Interesting. I'm just kind of reflecting on that a little bit, because it really is interesting looking at technology and how it has almost fostered that desire to just throw things out there and not worry about the outcomes or the consequences of what we throw out there.
Well, yeah, I think the technological focus of most of our lives, yours and mine, because we're close to the same age, roughly the same age, has been so focused on a certain kind of technology. And in a way, we've basically seeded a generation to that pursuit, right? Let's make smaller, more seamless communications technologies. And what that's resulted in is it's extremely easy for anyone to express themselves, right?
Yes.
And in theory, that should make it just as easy for anyone to hear someone else's expression and to understand it. But unfortunately, it doesn't really work that way, because attention is quite limited. If we're all spending a ton of our time and energy expressing ourselves today, that doesn't leave us with a ton of time and energy to take in someone else's expression. Right. And that's kind of the problem that we have in this attention economy, is that it's too often looked at from the input standpoint. Like, oh, this gives this technology exists, it gives everybody the ability to have a say. And the problem with everyone having the ability to have a say is that it just exponentially increases the amount of information that anyone's going to take in. And then how do they sort it out? And if they can't even sort it out, how are they going to give any of it a good listen?
Let alone something that's more difficult to capture than stuff like text, where text is, I mean, the algorithm makes sense to some degree, and I don't know anything about algorithms and text, but, you know, capturing that text down and being able to filter it seems a lot more doable than, say, a video or audio-only platform like Clubhouse.
Yeah, that's true. But the opposite is also true. I mean, how many times over the last year did social media blows up because some elected official says something that is horrific, and you read the quote and you're like, oh yeah, that's pretty bad. But then you watch the video and you're like, oh well, actually, it's not as bad as they made it seem, because you can tell the context changes it. You know, what did they say before that thing? What did they say after? What was their body language when they said it? Were they saying something in response to somebody else? You know, I think that happens all the time. And so on the one hand, it's easy to say that, yeah, text is a whole lot clearer and other forms of media are murkier because they have more information in them in other forms than just text. But sometimes the opposite is true. Because you have that additional information, you get a clarified meaning that you may not have in the text alone. It's also true that these technologies make it abundantly easy for everybody to communicate, to say what they want to say, but it doesn't really guarantee the quality of what somebody's going to say. In fact, it makes it so easy that few people are actually going to spend a whole lot of time self-editing before they put something out there. And again, as a result, how many times did you hear somebody who was publicly having their feet held to the fire for something they said, you know, that was recorded or written down or videotaped, and they'll immediately say, oh, well, I didn't really mean that. This is what I actually meant, you know, and maybe that's true. I mean, it's an easy way to get out of it, but it also could be true that they didn't actually quite mean that because they didn't really take the time to think through what they were going to say.
Because as we established earlier, haste makes waste.
Haste makes waste.
That's going to be the title of this episode.
Yeah, it could be the title of many episodes, I think. I mean, that came off as a dig. That is not what I meant at all.
What's funny is, like, right there is a perfect example of context.
Yes,
that you just, exactly. I mean, that's a perfect illustration.
It really is. Yeah, I guess you'll have to keep it and not cut it.
Oh, I'm not cutting that. That's brilliant. it is not only context, but the interpretation of the listener. So me as the listener, I could get really angry at that and be like, how dare you, make light of my podcast and all this stuff. Whereas I'm like, yeah, you're absolutely right. I was thinking of like the global context, right, not the personal context. Right. So well, I wasn't in my own head.
No, and I was also thinking of the fact that most of the people that you speak to are creatives and mm-hmm. I think creatives understand this more than anyone. You know, that's the creative process, is you try things out, you realize they don't work, you try them again, you realize they don't work, and you try them again, and you realize they don't work, and so on. You know, that in a nutshell is what designers and writers and creatives of all kinds, they basically live with that. They're never done.
Yeah. What's fascinating too is there's something that I read recently that I've really been challenged by, and it's like the difference between design thinking and arts thinking.
Hmm.
And like, you know, design thinking, you have the end result in mind and you're working to really refine and get to that end result. Whereas what was interesting was arts thinking is you aren't quite sure what the end result is. And so you're not only discovering it as you go, but the process is unfolding as well. It's really fascinating. And I almost need to explore that quote even more to really dive deeper into what the author meant by that.
Yeah. On the face of it, I like the idea. Something that's always bugged me about design thinking, I've never actually like compared it to the idea of arts thinking, but my experience as a designer has been that there's often not enough of an attitude or patience for or comfort with experimentation as you work. And that, as you just said, is sort of central to the arts thinking. You try things out. Yeah. And sometimes you try them out without even a hypothesis in mind. You intentionally let accidents happen. That's part of art making. And I think most designers that I know, that's a key part of their process too. But we don't really talk about that as honestly as we could or should, because I think we're afraid of scaring off the client.
Right. Yeah.
You know, but I mean, I can't tell you the number of times I've read about a designer's process or read about a designer that I respect, and some great thing that they did was largely the result of an accident, just like any other piece of art.
I mean, what does that say about the industry right there? It's just like there's so much fear wrapped into the work sometimes, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's because, you know, if you make art and no one buys it, then the risk is entirely held by the artist. Yeah. But, you know, people hire designers and start paying them before they've produced anything most of the time. I mean, it's design services are not sold the way pieces of art are sold.
Right.
And so risk is weighed out differently. And so reward is also weighed out differently.
Mm. I'm letting that one sink in. That's a little bit of a shift for me in thinking too, because I think the way that in the past I've approached business is, you know, it's like you're taking the artist's bearing of risk, but trying to operate as a business in that sense too. And that's, I think, where creatives, especially, you know, like myself, I've gotten in trouble when you don't have that separation between the process and the artist.
Right. Yeah. I think pricing of creative services is like a whole world, you know, it's extremely complicated. And I feel like I've learned a lot about that over the course of my career and continue to find it fascinating because of the fact that most creative individuals stumble into the sort of first realm of pricing the same way. They just, rather than trying to put a price on the product, they'll put a price on their time instead.
Yes.
And of course that has its problems. And so a lot of people who experiment with that and find it wanting will end up going back to putting a price on projects. Mm-hmm. And they feel that they can do that because after all of this time doing things, they've worked out a process that they can reproduce and gain efficiencies and be profitable on a project, even if they don't know exactly how much time it's going to take. Mm-hmm. But then they find that wanting too, because then you have to play all kinds of games of chicken with the market and the client, and you have to find creative ways of breaking up that price in a way that shares the risk and doesn't make you hanging on for that last 20% forever. Right. And so you can do things like amortization of prices, or you can build subscription models around creative services. You can even do performance-based pricing, which ultimately I think is probably the best fit if you are at all have an appetite for risk, because what you can do there is lower your initial price and then, you know, tack on a percentage based on some kind of tangible result. You know, so if you make something that leads to increased revenue for the client, you can ask for a piece of that. And they're betting on it just as you are at the beginning, you know?
Yeah.
And if they lose, if you don't have the result, well, they paid less than the market rate for the initial thing. So, I mean, anyway, there's a million different ways that you can do that. But I think they all show that really what's at stake is who's taking on the risk and when.
Yeah. What I appreciate about your answer there is that it really goes to what you said at the beginning of the conversation about how you are endlessly curious about so many things and your willingness to go deep on a subject. Like, I can tell you could talk for hours on this.
I probably could and should not, but it's true. I think, see, you just said that. I'm like, well, why wouldn't you go deep? Like, if you're curious about a thing, how can you not go deep? You know, few things are that shallow.
Like, even that phrase alone, we could like dive deep into and just talk for the rest of the conversation about.
That's a podcast title right there.
Yeah. Shallow versus depth.
Right. Exactly.
I'm loving this. I'm loving this conversation. There's something enjoyable about talking with you, Chris, because I feel like you've spent the time to really think about what is at the core of what it means to be human.
Well, I think that's giving me more credit. I think that's true. That's something I care about. But it's also somewhat presumptuous for anyone to say that they know what it means to be human, given how complicated we all are, and how different we all choose to live our lives, you know, how differently we all choose to live our lives. But I think that there are some commonalities, some things that are uniquely human, as opposed to things that are, you know, machine oriented or things that are natural to other kinds of creatures. You know, so I think that's what I tend to think about, and especially in regard to design and technology, because my experience as a designer has been one squarely within the technological space, which probably wouldn't have been true if I had come of age 30 years before when I did.
Right.
But because all of my design experience has been with interaction design, with screen-based systems and technologies, I constantly think about that push and pull. You know, how much of this human-created system actually allows a human to thrive, you know, in the end? Does it actually give to the human experience, or does it take away? And, you know, I'm constantly asking that question. I feel like most of the time when I ask myself that, I come up with a negative answer. You know, it takes it away. And I think I do generally have that worldview at this point, that I find myself fairly skeptical of the things that we've created as a culture in the last 30 years. And that isn't to say that they haven't brought about incredible amounts of good across society. But I wonder about the net impact sometimes. And again, you know, perhaps I'm not far enough through the story to properly weigh it out. But at this point in the story, it's hard for me to feel great about that. But I do think that that's something I get excited about and I care about, is being critical of design and technology, as opposed to just being a fanboy or being enthusiastic.
Right. Yeah. Perhaps in a few years, 10, 15 years, Walter Isaacson will still be alive and he'll write the definitive book about this period of time.
Perhaps so. Yeah. maybe he'll be one of those first guys to live to 120 and he's got like 10 more books to write about.
Exactly. So speaking of, you know, giant things of technology that you're analyzing and really diving deep into, let's just pick search engines, for example. I mean, there is a fascinating world around the concept of a search engine.
Yeah, there really is. You know, you're alluding to an article that I just wrote about that. And, you know, the article is about how our access to and our interaction with and our capacity to understand information has changed since the creation of the search engine. And I was really trying to frame in that article a current concern that I have about how we as a culture understand reality by looking critically at how search engines work and judging them by a standard that actually Richard Saul Wurman wrote about almost 30 years ago. Wurman is an architect who's spent most of his career thinking about information. And back in the late 80s, he wrote a book called Information Anxiety. And in that book, he talks about the gap that we all experience between what we understand and what we think we understand. In other words, between what we know and what we know about, right? That is information anxiety. And one thing that Wurman talks about is how information is organized. And that's going to be what connects to search engines. He says that information can only really be organized five ways: by category, by time, by location, alphabet, and continuum. And when I first read that, I was really thrown by that last one, continuum.
Yeah, that's interesting.
What he's talking about there is arranging information by priority. For example, if you're on Amazon.com and you sort results by average customer rating, you're sorting by continuum. Same thing if you're sorting by price. And continuum is basically moving information around in a sorting way, and there has to be some qualifier for the sort, right? Now, once I got past the instinct that I initially felt that there must be more ways beyond these five, and there really aren't. I challenge anyone listening to come up with another way. Right. I did find myself wondering, okay, so which of Wurman's five ways of organizing information is how search engines work? When Google makes good on its mission to organize the world's information, how exactly does it do that? So before you can get into how Google orders information, you first have to understand how they find it in the first place. So they use programs called spiders. We've all heard this before, but I think actually few people really understand how it works. They use programs called spiders that crawl the web, right? And those spiders look for links. And if they can find a link, they follow the link. And that gives them a kind of a map of the web, a map of URLs, of web page addresses. And as they crawl the web, they reconstruct that map along with the information that's contained on the pages that are the landmarks on the map. And they look at the metadata of those pages. That's the information that describes the information, like this is a title, this is a list, etc. And they try and decipher what kind of information is on those pages. That's how it works, to put it dangerously simply. There's probably someone, you know, listening who's like a real SEO expert and would want to quibble with that. But in a nutshell, that's how it works. Once they have all that information indexed, the question then becomes, how do they decide which of it to point you to when you search for something? And this is what gets to the question of my concern, right? You know, what am I actually concerned about today? A key aspect of Google's algorithm is something called PageRank, which is named for one of Google's founders, Larry Page. And in Google's own words, they describe it like this: it works by counting the number and quality of links to a page to determine a rough estimate of how important that website is. The underlying assumption is that the more important websites are likely to receive more links from other websites. So what does that sound like to you? In other words, it's a popularity contest, right? Now, understanding search engines has been important to how I make things and how I advise that other people make things, because the persistent implied purpose of all of it is what? To be found, to be seen, to be engaged with. And so over the course of my career, how I've received that explanation from Google about how it works, this sort of fundamental assumption that they make about importance, it's really changed over that time. 15 years ago, I'd probably have thought that organization by authority made good sense, right? I can recall times of reading that where I'm like, yeah, that sounds pretty good to me. But today, with the accumulated power that Google has, I find it to be an outrageously cynical method with this huge, wide open back door, right, for exploitation. And so I think that Wurman didn't include organization by authority in his list of ways information can be organized for a good reason, right? Authority is too subjective. It's kicking continuum's can, right? It's authority, but authority vested by whom, or importance according to what? So not to mention, by the way, but authority is way too vulnerable, as I mentioned a second ago, to exploitation, right? You can cheat that. And so here we are more than 25 years after Google was created, and most people depend on Google searches to understand reality, to understand what's going on in the world and why. And if the answers they get from Google are there because they just happen to get the most links and the most traffic, well, that seems like a pretty big problem to me. Right? Most Google users think that they're getting answers from Google, but what they're really getting are sources of answers, and the truth of which hasn't even been evaluated by Google.
Right.
So that affects culture, right? what does it mean when we say we, or we talk about a culture, right? A culture or corporations, I think was something you were interested about before we started talking.
Yeah.
And I think that any definition of we actually represents its own culture, right? Culture is just a collection of agreements. Mm-hmm. But what bothers me about cultural definition in 2021 is just how much of that definition, how many of those agreements we've ceded to corporations.
Right.
How much of daily life is defined by how corporations want daily life to work and how they make us act, right, to make to use their stuff, basically.
What immediately conjures in my mind is things about how technology has shifted our consumption of information. So whether it's like music and the advent of the MP3, which, you know, created the you know, way that we consume media now in terms of music, to, you know, what we've seen with cinema and how it's shifting painfully in many instances from the theater model to a streaming model, and what that means for the revenue impact on filmmakers. It's really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, all of this technology that I think is primarily motivated by reducing friction, increasing convenience, you know, that sort of thing, which we've kind of prioritized above everything else.
Yeah.
It's amazing what it results in, you know, the sort of unforeseens, mm-hmm, of all this technology. So, you know, for example, I find it highly ironic that when streaming services first were made available to, mm-hmm, the average consumer, one of the major pitches of those streaming services was, oh, you can cut the cord. You don't have to pay for cable anymore, right? Yeah. Think about how much less money you'll spend. You pay for Netflix, it's $9.95 a month, and you can end your cable bill, which is $40 a month, because after all, like, how much of that is what you want anyway? Mm-hmm. And that sounds pretty good, right?
It does.
The problem is that once that becomes a proven means of doing business, right? I mean, once you prove a streaming service, then everybody wants to get in on that. And so now we've got, I don't know, hundreds of streaming services you could possibly pay for. And it would be fine if you could get away with not paying for all of them. But what's ended up happening now is the people who own the rights to the media are being very choosy about where their media shows up. So if you want to watch such and such a thing, you got to get Disney Plus, or you got to get Apple Plus, or you got to get HBO, whatever. And all of a sudden, you're paying more than you ever paid for cable. Mm-hmm. Right? So, and that's kind of like, that's a long tail effect, right? The initial value prop was right. Yeah, mm-hmm, cut the cable bill. You don't watch 80% of that anyway. Just pay for Netflix. But all of a sudden, you find yourself 10 years later, you know, paying what you used to pay, if not more, for cable, and you don't even get now the access that you want to have. Before, the problem was you were overpaying for stuff that you didn't want. Now you're overpaying and you still don't get what you want.
Oh my gosh. And the cable companies have figured out that if you want the top tier speeds, you got to buy the package.
Yes.
Yeah. So they've not only figured out a way to, like, get back at the cord cutters.
Well, and you know, another cost of the last 4 years is that net neutrality kind of just got completely rampaged. Yeah. So in you know, it's totally a free market to not only, you know, price gouge for certain kinds of connectivity, but also you know, throttle certain sources that take, mm-hmm, up more bandwidth. And so that can mess with the system quite a bit.
So what's interesting is, like, I want to return quickly to this idea of distortion of reality, because I think whether it's a search engine or whether it's streaming media or, you know, social media, you know, it's a distortion, I think, of reality.
Well, all of it is. Yeah. I mean, you know, back, I forget when it was written, but when Eli Pariser wrote The Filter Bubble, you know, he was talking about how algorithms basically initially around the content space were written and the social space to sort of anticipate your interests and needs based on what you put into the system. All the information you tell the system basically tells them something about you such that they, mm-hmm, can start to show you something that's relevant to you, mm-hmm, which in a nutshell sounds kind of good, right? It's personalization.
Yeah.
The problem with that is that when your entire experience of the world becomes mediated by personalization algorithms, you don't get exposed to things that don't agree with you. right? And Facebook, I think, is a great example of this, where we've seen over the last handful of years, people overestimating the degree to which the world agrees with them, or the degree to which a problem is actually a problem, or the truth of a lie, because they see it repeated over and over again within Facebook, because Facebook elevates it to them, because Facebook has identified algorithmically that this is relevant to them, that this is what they want. And then, you know, among their friends who tell Facebook more things, Facebook looks at those and says, well, which of these things are sort of part of this person's preferences? And it becomes a sort of an echo chamber, right? It all confirms one's reality. And so you can find yourself in a space quite easily there where you think that, oh yeah, everyone in the world thinks this, when actually that's not true at all. And another version of that is, you know, when you go to a Google search engine, you start typing in a search, right? And it starts to complete it for you. One thing that does, it's, you know, in theory, a convenience, right? It allows you to not have to worry too much about, like, am I framing this search right to get the right result? You know, because if someone else already searched for that, you say, okay, well, then there must be an answer. And in a way, that's kind of nice, right? Like, if you were just building from an information architecture standpoint, some kind of search interface, you might try to do something just like that, so that it speeds up a person's ability to get an answer. But the other weird thing that it does is it tells that person, oh yeah, you're not alone. Right? Other people feel this way. Other people ask the same question. And not only does it do that, but when, you know, it's not that Google shows the same preview of a query to everyone, right? They show you the one that they think you need. Yeah. And so if you've told Google a bunch of things already about how you see the world, it's going to complete that search query based upon that information. And so, you know, if you start typing in all kinds of weird queries about the last election and what's a hoax and what's not, and what's a coup and what's not, it's going to filter according to what it thinks you want. And then it just confirms your reality. So, you know, reality gets distorted by a series of confirmations that are not actually informed by enough information. They're informed by a smaller amount of information that is preferred by the receiver, by you. And so I think that partially, you know, one of the ongoing themes for me has been that the algorithm has been a mistake, right? Largely. It's not that, like, algorithms are inherently bad, right? They're just a mathematical and dialectical approach to getting to something. But I think that they've been used for the sake of convenience and speed and optimization and reducing of friction, but we haven't thought about what the long-term costs are going to be. And this is one of them. The long-term cost of convenience has been that we are locking people into these little filter bubbles and they literally cannot see outside of them.
I'm having a Jeff Goldblum moment here from Jurassic Park, you know? Never thought to consider that we should bring dinosaurs back.
Right. Well, or just because you can make something doesn't mean you should.
Yes, that was the quote. Thank you. I had Jeff Goldblum in my head.
Yeah. Well, whenever you say that, I think about his weird laugh in the helicopter, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, Chris, just the way that you dive into these topics is so fascinating. And I think the other topic that I would love to touch on in the time we have left is something that I've been thinking a lot about, and it's about dreaming big. And what's so fascinating about it?
Well, dreaming big is hard, right? It's really hard to dream big. I think a lot of people think that it's too easy, and therefore people have these big ideas and they're reckless with them. And, you know, I think that there are plenty of examples of that. Could someone consider Jeff Bezos's big idea to have an aerospace company? Is that a reckless idea? Maybe. You know, it's weird to think, like, you know, do we have any right trying to be an interplanetary society? Like, we're not even planetary, you know, like, right. we can barely exist here. But, you know, I think what's harder is for the average person to dream big, you know, because I think most people don't think that they have the ability to put a big dream into action, right? They feel locked in by their circumstances. And also, you know, there are intellectual barriers to dreaming big. You know, the more you understand about how things work in the world, the more obstructions there are to envisioning something else, right? I was talking to a friend a few weeks ago about this, and that actually prompted another article, which is probably where your question came from, about dreaming big. And, you know, she works with organizations that provide care for trauma survivors. Mm. And she consults them on how to optimize their systems of care, how to create new programs, things like that. She has a master's in public health. She comes from a public health standpoint. But whenever she encourages them to think a little bit bigger, she finds that they always get locked down into something. For instance, she'll say, well, you know, like, what are some ways that we could provide better care? And the first thing, you know, that someone might come up with is like, well, you know, we could change this weird fine print in the healthcare system, you know, you know, maybe we could, you know, get to a single payer system. And she's like, no, that's not big enough. That's just an optimization of the existing situation, that the existing system. What she's trying to say is like, let's think bigger beyond the systems in which we're navigating today. And that's just hard to do. And, you know, it's hard to do because we're all entrapped in these systems and they're all interwoven in our lives. It's not just like you can put your mind in the healthcare system and think about those systems while not also thinking about transportation systems and food systems and logistics systems and all those things. They're all interwoven and they make our day-to-day life what it is. But I think another thing about that is that big change costs a lot. And for some people, that cost is something they're willing to pay. Whereas for other people, they're not. You know, that same friend was talking to me about how encouraged she's been by reading speculative fiction in parallel with doing this work, you know, because she's noticed that in certain cultures, the speculative fiction is much more willing to think big about radical changes to culture and to systems because they've got nothing to lose. Right. In particular, she's talked a lot about Afrofuturism and how Afrofuturism is much more comfortable with post-apocalyptic settings that are optimistic, as opposed to what we in the West sort of have with our doom porn. You know, we love post-apocalyptic stories where everything's awful and we're eating each other. And her perspective is, it's because for them, there's no other way. You know, the current situation is harmful to them. So, you know, destroying the current situation is worth it. Whereas, you know, for some people it may not be. But the truth is that big change is costly to anyone. And you don't know if you're going to be the one to benefit from it. You know, that and that's where it comes back down to, you know, why are you trying to bring that change out in the first place? You know, are you willing to bring about a big enough change even if you're not going to be there to benefit from it. Right. Because if it's good enough, it should be worthy of your effort and your time, even if you don't get the benefits.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that's why it's hard to dream big, because it requires all of those things. And that's really hard to manage.
Right. Because what's interesting is, like, I didn't really consider the follow-up question to that is, there's one thing about having a big vision or a big dream for your life, but it's also a question of who's going to take that over for you when you're no longer here.
Right.
And is that big enough?
That's why for me, the big dream is small. I'm not interested in fame or wealth. I'm not interested in like a grandiose life, you know? In fact, I was playing catch with my brother-in-law once, and he's like a huge baseball fan. And he was talking about how much he wishes he could have played baseball professionally. And I said to him, yeah, but have you ever thought about what that life actually would be? You know, you could never go to that coffee shop you like again. You know, you couldn't go anywhere without being followed, without checking with somebody first. Your whole life would change. And that is the cost of wealth and fame in this world, is the loss of kind of the freedom of anonymity. And you know, that's just an existential thing that I wouldn't want that. But also, you know, there is something to be said for really being skeptical of the sort of American dream of wealth. We can all be like, we can all be like Trump if we wanted to. It's no, we can't, there's not enough resources for that. And it's a bad move for society to encourage people to want that kind of success, to want that kind of material wealth, because there isn't enough of it to go around. And oftentimes wealth itself is defined not just in terms of a certain amount that everyone could have, right? But, you know, compared to someone else, like how much do I have compared to someone else? So yeah, for me, I just, All I want is a simple life. The problem is, how do I convince the rest of the world to want that too? That to me is a big dream. Isn't that ironic? Like, my big dream is just a simple life where I don't have to necessarily be stressed out about how I'm going to keep a roof over my head and keep food on the table, right? I don't need, you know, stretch limos waiting to take me places. I don't need, you know, shiny suits and jewels. You know, I don't need any of that stuff. But what I want is really quite modest in the grand scheme of things. But the big dream is, how do I get, or how can we get everyone in the world to want that too?
Right.
Or in other words, how can we get everyone in the world to want something just as much for their neighbor as for themselves? Because it's the same thing. If you want something small and you believe that everybody in the world could actually have that kind of life, then you have to want it as much for other people as you want it for yourself, right? You have to participate in that. And to me, it's like, that's both a very small dream and a very big dream.
Right. And what I love about that is individually, like, that's attainable. Like, I feel like right now, if your dream is to have a simple life, that there's something in that that's actionable and doable and attainable.
Yeah.
But the big shift is what you just said, wanting that for your neighbor too. Mm-hmm. Like, that goes against our societal programming in a lot of ways.
It does, which is really strange and sad. You know, it's really strange and sad that, well, and why, in a way, it's strange and sad to me, because it's so contradictory to what community and society is supposed to be, right? Society isn't a series of buildings in which people live, you know, with a series of services attached to them, right? Society is a group of people who agree on things, you know, agree on ideas and things and participate in them together. So you can have a society where there are no houses, you know, you could have a society that looks like a city. Yeah. And so I think a lot of times our definition of society gets quite weighed down by the accoutrements of society, like the things that we make. Mm-hmm. And we forget about, you know, why we make those things and why we're alive in the first place. And, you know, if you get to that line of thinking, it is impossible to not think about who lives next door, who lives across the street, who's in my family, who are my friends, who are my colleagues. You know, those are the people that you depend on. And if you want to have another way into that line of thinking, you think about what would happen in some kind of catastrophic scenario. You know, back to my friend's idea that, you know, certain kinds of post-apocalyptic literature is more comfortable with the after, because they're comfortable with dreaming big and losing out on what they have today. All of those scenarios depend on human cooperation afterwards, right? You really start to learn about how essential someone else's help is once all that stuff falls away. But in our country, when when we're even thinking about the possibility of calamity, we just hoard toilet paper instead. You know, that's how we process staring into the void. Is, well, as long as I have some toilet paper, I'll be all right.
That's right. It's the holy trinity of toilet paper, hand sanitizer, and internet.
Right. Exactly. I have, if I can watch Netflix and go to the bathroom and, you know, have my little Howard Hughes bunker, then I'll be fine. You know,
that's right. Cause what's interesting is, like, you know, the last year has really taught us the importance of, you know, having a big dream or goal.
Yep.
And then how hard it is to actually put that into action and to mobilize people around something that is for the public good, the greater good.
Yes. And, oh God, I mean, well, and that, you know, the greater good, that's a big idea. That's a huge idea. And it should be the aggregate of just millions, billions of people living out a small idea, shouldn't it? Mm-hmm. Right? Isn't that, that's what the public good is? Mm-hmm. Or in other words, you know, a big idea being that what's good for all of us could be good for us individually, even if the goodness of it is not equally experienced. You know, in other words, I think something that people are terrified of when it comes to, like, you know, communist or socialist structures is this idea that somebody might get just as much even though they didn't put the work in, right? But the problem is that not everyone is created equal to do the work. right? You know, there are people on this planet who deserve to live. They deserve to be treated with the same dignity as you and I. They deserve to have just as much goodness in their life as you and I do, but they can't do things physically that you and I might be able to do. And so in a scenario where, you know, if you have to envision that idea of like, okay, the world shut down and we have this little commune going and some of us are going to have to start digging ditches and building fences and things like that. Like, yeah, there's going to be people who literally cannot do that, but should they get some eggs on a certain morning? Yeah. You know, and so we have to share things despite the inputs being different. We have to share things even if not all of us put in the same amount of work. That's the common good in a nutshell, mm-hmm. right? Is that everybody deserves a certain experience, deserves a certain amount of care, deserves a certain standard of living, a certain amount of rights, even if not everyone puts in the same. That's the whole point. Mm-hmm. But man, that does that not go against the American way?
Exactly. Although I do have to admit that last year, towards the end of the year, I finally got around to reading Stephen King's The Stand. Uh-huh. And he does kind of approach, you know, what you're talking about, where some people are going to be able to do things that others can't in the rebuilding of society.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course. Of course.
Well, Chris, as always, it is a pleasure to dive into the deep end of the pool with you.
Likewise.
And I'm curious, you know, what book, podcast, or resource is blowing your mind right now?
Yeah, so I thought about this, and I've got a few books that I'm in the middle of at the moment.
Nice.
But one that has really been a surprise and a joy for me has been one that came out recently. It's Brian Eno's diary. It's Ooh. Called A Year with Swollen Appendices. And he published this diary. I think it's fairly unedited. And I have just really learned a lot from it. You know, he's a brilliant person.
Yeah.
And his diary is all over the place. You know, it was a year in the late 90s that he was writing it. So you get to hear about his work on, you know, working on albums with David Bowie or with U2, things like that. You get to hear about that. Mm-hmm. But you also get to hear the mind of this person. Mm-hmm. And I have found that the sort of intimate throwaway parts of the journal are the parts that I've enjoyed the most, where, you know, he's describing having walked down the street on the way to something, or, you know, he's describing how his very banal day went. And what that gives me is this sense of place at a time when people weren't kind of inundated by every possible signal of things happening outside of your life.
Yeah.
You know, for example, he talks about sitting down to write his diary at the end of a day. And for him, that meant going into the one room in the house that had a computer and sitting down at that chair and typing this in kind of Doogie Howser style into a very plain screen that wasn't connected to anything. He doesn't hit tweet at the end. He doesn't post it to Facebook. It's just this text document that only he gets to see. And then he saves it and goes into the rest of his house that's totally unwired. He goes and makes dinner and listens to music with his wife and plays with his kids. And then maybe he checks in 2 days later. And I just think about, wow, that kind of life that we don't have anymore, because the inputs were fewer. And the world he describes is one of sort of a really customized and, what's the word? Thinking of a very particular word that I can't muster at the moment. But, you know, he's crafted this reality for himself and he's maintained it. And I read that and it's easy for me to say, yeah, I can't live a life like that anymore because there's Twitter and every room in my house has a machine in it. But it's like, no, I actually can. I can. And I've started too. So I think ultimately the diary is really fascinating because it gives you some insight into a person who I think is very unique as an artist, as a thinker. The kinds of things he thinks about and talks about are very diverse, but it's also just intimate. And that has been the thing that's impressed me the most. It's made me recognize how precious the unseen and unshared moments are in our lives. And they weren't as precious to Brian Eno in this diary. He didn't realize how precious they'd become 20 years later. But now, you know, a couple of decades later, reading this diary, I realize that that's the biggest difference. It's not just that here's a guy who's living before these pieces of social media or these technologies or these devices or these events, but it's a person who's living at a time where these kinds of intimate day-to-day moments were much more common, much more abundant, and we can get back to that if we want it, if we find it as interesting and compelling as I think you would if you read the book.
Yeah, that's interesting, because when I think of the late 90s, I think of the commitment that it took to get online.
You were
committed into it.
If you were going to do anything technological, the work was significant.
Whereas when you're committing to that, you're also committing to, you know, you're seeing it through to the end. And I think commitment has a different definition than what commitment means now.
Yeah, I would imagine that's probably true. I think that, but I'm not sure that that's really a technological thing so much as that's just, well, gosh, I mean, you know, the way I start to think about that is having the ability to think back 20 years, right? Mm-hmm. And evaluate that idea over the course of two decades of adult life. But if there's a 20-year-old listening to your podcast right now, I think they might think about that or answer it quite differently. So I think time plays a significant role in evaluating that too.
That's right. My dad would have a completely different answer than me versus a 20-year-old. So yep,
that's with mine.
Whew, fascinating.
Yep.
Well, Chris, as always, it is a pleasure to talk with you. It's a pleasure to spend time with you and to have my mind expanded and broadened into new territory. Thank you, thank you, thank you for the work that you're doing, the writing that you're putting out into the world. And thank you for the big dream of a simple life.
Well, thanks for talking to me about that. Thanks for inviting me. It's an honor to be invited, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you too. I really enjoy our time.
I absolutely loved this conversation with Chris. He's such an inspiration to me. And yeah, I've talked to him twice before on Getting Work to Work, so you'll find the links to those past conversations in the show notes page. I also highly recommend checking out his website, the link's there as well. Sign up for his weekly email newsletter. It's such thought-provoking content. Thank you, Chris, for being here yet again and just sharing your depth and wisdom with us. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.